Sometimes in football, you need just a little more for that first down. You need to be pushing the pile. And on our new podcast, we'll give you that extra effort.
I'm Mike Renner, a longtime NFL analyst who helped develop player evaluation systems that every NFL team uses to this day.
And I'm Kyle Long, former all-pro offensive lineman in the NFL who knows a thing or two about getting people moving.
You'll get expertise from inside the trenches and behind the tape for 4 episodes every week. So make sure you download and subscribe to the Pushing the Pile podcast on the Audio.
It's the Hoffman Show. We're on the Team 980, always live as well on the free Odyssey app. Coming up at 5:30, never read the comments, our final preseason edition, some thoughts on some of the predictions we made. And then 6 o'clock hour, it is time for all of the predictions. Yeah, we're going to go through each division, pick our winner. We're running out of time because the NFL opens tonight. Ravens Chiefs here on the Team 980, courtesy of Westwood One. But yeah, we're going to pick every division winner. We're going to pick Super Bowl winner. We're going to pick MVP, Offensive Defensive Player of the Year, Offensive Defensive Rookie of the Year. You know the deal. So 6 o'clock is prediction hour. But right now, man, nothing better to welcome in football season than one of our smartest friends of the show. It is time for Not My Beat.
Today's top story from the perspective of someone who's there.
You are looking live.
This just in.
Not My Beat.
Joining us now here on the day that football is back, it's our friend Dan Orlovsky from ESPN. Of course, you can watch him on NFL Live and every other NFL show or NFL adjacent show that they have. Dano, it's back. Football is here. How you doing?
I'm doing great, man. You know, as excited as anybody that football is back, it's funny going through the summer, you know, so often see people and they're like, man, can't wait. We're getting close to football coming back. You know, I can't wait. And I'm always like, nah, you know what? It can hold off, you know, because the season is so long. But now that it's here, obviously wildly excited.
Yeah, absolutely. So Jaden Daniels will make his pro debut this weekend against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. It's a heck of a challenge. Before we get to that game specifically, what have you seen from Jaden throughout the preseason and in talking to anybody that you know around the building that has either confirmed some of the things that you were excited about with Daniels coming out of the draft or maybe even surprised you one way or the other about him as he heads into his debut?
Yeah, I think when you see the reports of how he's performed in camp and how he's carried himself and the leadership element and the work ethic, it makes you feel great about some of the, at least the beliefs that you had in the young man, certainly me personally. And then you watch some of the, albeit small sample size in the preseason, but and obviously the throw down the field, down the right sideline against the Jets was beautiful in week one. And then some of the throws against Miami with the ball placement and really putting it on the right shoulder, because that was certainly a strength of his. And so while it being a small body of work, you know, it's nice to see that the stuff that I felt was really the strength of his game in college easily showed itself in the NFL. And I understand it's simplified in the preseason, but it's nice to see that. And so everything you hear about the young man is in a positive fashion, and the excitement behind kind of what he's shown so far on a day-to-day basis. So I'm wildly excited for him and in Washington and kind of seeing, you know, how quickly he can get up to speed at the NFL level.
So one thing that I've talked about quite a bit since the draft is something that you said like the week of the draft when you came on the show that all of a sudden kind of shape-shifted the way I was looking at Daniels and really like took my excitement about him to another level, which is you thought he had the best eyes in the draft. And I think about actually a play where he throws the ball out of bounds against Miami when he sees that they messed up the protection on the blitz and he throws it over
McLaurin's head.
Yep, exactly.
Yep.
And so to see that come to life, my question for you, Dan, is like, what's the difference doing that in a preseason? Because that was a game where Miami had a little bit more in, but it's still not real regular season NFL football. Everything is so vanilla now in the preseason. What is the difference in doing that in the preseason or in camp versus what he's going to face, especially against a blitz master in Todd Bowles on Sunday?
Yeah, I think, well, specifically in general, during the preseason, it's great that you see it, and it's great that you, like, you don't take the hit and you throw it away. But there's no negative consequence to that result. The difference is in the regular season, you know, the wins and losses matter. You know, the not converting on third down matters. The not hurting a defense doing it matters. And that's really the philosophy when you're playing against teams that pressure you defensively. Offensively, there's one of two things. You can either protect against it, meaning, hey, we just want to make sure bad stuff doesn't happen. So it's a get the ball to your hands. You could throw it away, or you could check to a play, maybe get to a perimeter screen, something like that. Or you could try and hurt it. Hey, if you're going to blitz me and I feel like I got a beat on it, I'm going to try to hurt you. I'm going to try to gut you. And so you really want to live in the world of trying to gut teams. You got to have the right people. You got to have the right quarterback and the right perimeter players to do it. And so it's great that happens in the preseason and you show that, okay, I saw it, but it doesn't matter that, oh man, it's a third down and we're out of field goal range or something like that. In the regular season, it will. And so I think that's really what you want to see is, you know, can you really, you know, make those impactful plays when they matter and games are on the line? And he's going to get a baptism by fire, no question, week one against Todd Bowles.
So what is it that makes, in your mind, Bowles' blitz package so, I don't know if you'd call it unique, special, rare, like, yep. I don't know if he's one of, you would say like, oh, he's one of one, or, you know, one of the best of a certain tree, but what makes it so dang hard to play against? I'll phrase it that way.
Yeah, options, variety, you know, and it's almost like if you take an offensive football and if everyone closes their eyes and they think of the Kyle Shanahan offense or the Matt LaFleur offense, there's so much that comes off of one formation or one action. And that's what causes the defense to play so hesitant. And it's the same way with Todd Bowles as a blitz guy. He'll give anything pressure-wise and coverage-wise that can come off of it. And he'll run the same pressure in two different ways with two different coverages. And you sit there and go, well, the last time you showed me this look, you brought those two blitzers and you played man coverage, but this time you put that same look in those same two blitzers, but you played cover two behind it. And so it's just the options that he has off of very similar looks. And that forces, you know, when you're playing against blitz, it takes everybody. It's not just the quarterback. So you got to have everybody in your offensive line seeing it the same way and executing it the same way. And your receiver's got to see it the same way and executing it. And the same with your backs. And if one person's wrong, your quarterback gets their head taken off or he's running for his life. And so that's really the biggest challenge. You got to get all 11 on the same page. And they force you to do it in a really quick amount of time. And you got to think really at a high and efficient level. And so I think that's the big challenge, Craig. And then I would say this, you know, what's going to be the really – The one of the most interesting parts in this game is we saw a sprinkle of tempo in the preseason from this offense. Cliff's done it in his past. Jaden's obviously done it in college. How much are they going to do it? And when they're doing it, two things. One, how much does that calm down some of the blitzing from Bowles? It will a little bit, but not that much. And, you know, you could have a tendency as a quarterback when you play with tempo, you can think that you're not going to get pressure or exotics. And I think Washington will. And how does Jaden in tempo handle that stuff in a calm manner? I think that's going to be huge this weekend.
Dan Orlovsky, ESPN NFL analyst with us here on the Hoffman Show on the Team 980. So how can Cliff help that? Obviously, he can get in his headset and be like, hey, remember, it's still Todd Bowles calling defenses. You're going to get pressure. There's the kind of that mental preparation. But then schematically, obviously, there's stuff he can do as well. Knowing Cliff's offense like you do, having studied it with the intensity that you have, what are some of the things that you think are on the table as options to help insulate Jaden this weekend?
Yeah, I think changing your tempo is a big deal. You know, not just playing fast, but sometimes playing super fast, sometimes playing fast, sometimes playing kind of at a medium pace, sometimes getting there and taking your time and trying to gather information and making sure that, you know, you can use that in-head communication, you know, as long as possible. I think the second thing is, you know, make sure that everyone's really greased in their rules. You know, sometimes early on in the season, you can get yourself into trouble if you're constantly chasing perfection in these situations, but really just what are the rules of this protection? I don't care. What the defense is saying or not. What is the rule? Okay, if that person blitzes, he's not blocked for. And making sure that you're not trying to chase perfection early on, I think the more that you can get the ball out in some type of perimeter screen, the better, especially, you know, with downs that you might anticipate a pressure. So you got, let's live in the world where it's second and eight. Don't wait till third down to call that screen. Get it out in second down and see if you can hurt that defense with an easy decision and a mental break for Jaden. So I think those are the big things, you know, is making sure that you're not stressing him. You're not stressing that offensive line too much.
All right, Dan, I'm going to try to ask a nerdy football question without losing the audience here. So bear with me just a moment as I explain. Running the football sounds easy. It's like block the guy ahead of you. But when teams install runs, they have to account for all the different alignments that a defense is going to throw at them. So that, of course, is good so far explaining this to the audience. The challenge, I think, this weekend for this run game for Washington is they have practiced mostly against a four-down front, their own front throughout all of training camp. The Jets play some three. The Dolphins play some three down. But Tampa plays a lot of three down fronts, and they move guys around, and it's super tricky to kind of target those runs. As a quarterback, as an offensive line, Tyler Biadasz has a lot on his plate. That's the long windup, Dan, to how hard is it in your experience, having played and studied the game, you know, playing for 12 years, all that kind of stuff, to do that, especially in week one coming out of training camp, where you get in a rhythm of doing against your own guys and the slight sprinkle of a joint practice, because running the football obviously is something this team wants to do, and doing it, it's not that you can't run on Tampa, it's just you got to do it differently. How hard is that adjustment in week one?
Yeah, it's big time challenge, and then you throw in the reality that you just can't replicate a Vita Vea. You just can't, no matter how hard you try. So, I think a couple of things are really important in that conversation. Number one, I've always believed 3-4 defenses were harder in any element to prepare for, just because, you know, it's the numbers. There's four people off the ball more often, so there's more movement. So there's that reality, and so teams do a really good job of understanding. Really good coaches do a good job of understanding, okay, there's plays that we won't run. We just will not call them versus 3-4 defenses and vice versa. So a 3-4 defense, you kind of want to try to live a little bit more on running the ball inside, because you have those off-the-ball linebackers. And 4-3 defenses, you want to try to at times get the ball on the outside. So I think you try to make sure that you're paying attention to that. If you're Cliff Kingsbury and understanding this is what they're going to try and do now, again, the Vita Vea element of that is the big challenge. So is it trying to run it in inside and always making sure that they're double teaming him? I think that's paramount. Number two, during practices, you know, again, well-coached football teams will make sure, even in a good versus good situation, you could have the conversation. And what I mean by that is starter versus starters. You know, Cliff Kingsbury can go to Dan Quinn and say, like, hey, during this run period, can you only get into 3-4 formations for us? I want to, you know, take this run period on August 18th, and we're going to really work on our run game versus 3-4. So you can try to bank some reps against that stuff and see what you're good at and see what you're not good at. And then your guys have recall. So there are certainly plays that you won't call run game wise because of just the base defensive formation from Tampa.
No doubt. And I also do wonder, defensively for Washington, with Trezon Newton in the fold, assuming that he's healthy, like, do they get to a point this year where, especially if Jamin Davis can continue to make the progress on the edge, like with him, Dante Fowler, Frankie Louvu, like, do they go three down in Washington? That could be a thing defensively for them that they have in their back pocket that they haven't shown yet. Last thing for Dan Orlovsky here, of course, NFL analyst for ESPN, is that Washington defense. Baker, you know, obviously had a great year last year under Canales. He leaves, takes the head coaching job in Carolina. Liam Cohn comes in as the offensive coordinator, last in the NFL in 2022 with Sean and the Rams. How do you think what Cohen's background is matches up with the success that Baker's had, not just last year, but the last year he had in Cleveland under Kevin Stefanski as well?
Yeah, I expect them to not skip a beat offensively. If you go in Baker, the last two seasons that he's played healthy, he's a pretty darn good player. And most of his career has been in the scheme that Liam Cohen is going to call. You know, Liam cut his teeth a little bit from the Sean McVay tree, to your point. He's been part of that organization a couple times. And so that's what Kevin Stefanski runs. That's obviously what he ran in Cleveland. He ran it with the Rams. Canales was a little bit less, but, you know, Canales having a little bit of time in Seattle, you know, had somewhat of a background on it. So I think that you'll see this football team offensively in Tampa be a little bit more like Cleveland Baker's offense, which more play action, more crossers, more trying to hit chunks. You're still going to live in a little bit of the drop back shotgun game that Canales brought because of their perimeter players, McMillan being the addition from Washington this year as well. So this offense will probably be a 80% what he ran in Cleveland and 20% what Canales did with them.
Makes sense. Dan Orlovsky, ESPN NFL analyst. You can watch him on NFL Live, on Get Up, on SportsCenter, on all the other programs. You guys got a lot of them up there. The whole worldwide leader thing. Not a nice wide swath of programming. Dan's on all of it, of course, talking ball. Always appreciate your time here on the show, man. And we'll talk to you again later in the season.
All right, buddy. Thank you.
Orlovsky, everybody, from ESPN. You gotta love that. When we get back here on the Hoffman Show, we're going to talk about one of the, I don't know, 10 most important sports figures in the U.S. of the last 20 years retiring. Surprise announcement that came today. We'll do that briefly, and then we will get on to Never Read the Comments at 5:30 on the Team 980.
Sometimes in football, you need just a little more for that first down. You need to be pushing the pile. And on our new podcast, we'll give you that extra effort.
I'm Mike Renner, a longtime NFL analyst who helped develop player evaluation systems that every NFL team uses to this day.
And I'm Kyle Long, former all-pro offensive lineman in the NFL who knows a thing or two about getting people moving.
You'll get expertise from inside the trenches and behind the tape for 4 episodes every week. So make sure you download and subscribe to the Pushing the Pile podcast on the Odyssey.
It's the Hoffman Show. We're on the Team 980, always live as well on the free Odyssey app. Never read the comments at 5:30, and we pick everything. Every division winner, conference winners, Super Bowl winners, MVP, all of it coming up in the 6 o'clock hour as the Ravens and Chiefs kick off the NFL season tonight. But Anthony Haney, Hey, you over there. If at any point in the last 10 years, I said, name one women's soccer player, who would you have said?
There's a couple.
Okay, you're a little more locked in than the average bear.
Okay, Megan Rapinoe, uh-huh. Alex Morgan.
Yep, that's really probably.
Julie Ertz.
Okay, Julie, wow, that's a deep cut for most people.
And the goalie was Solo?
Yeah.
Hope Solo?
Apparently some really bizarre Netflix documentary just came out on her. Not a good time.
Never mind.
But for most people,
scratch that one.
Pino and Alex Morgan would have been the two. And frankly, I think Alex Morgan would probably win that popularity contest by a lot. And that made it quite surprising when all of a sudden, today, I'm just out there perusing the old Twitter timeline. And lo and behold, all of a sudden, there's a post from Alex Morgan. Actually, I was on Instagram first when I saw this. Post from Alex Morgan. It just says, thank you, has heart hands, and this is what it said.
I'm going to get to the point quickly. I'm retiring, and I have so much clarity about this decision, and I'm so happy to be able to finally tell you. It has been a long time coming, and this decision wasn't easy. But at the beginning of 2024, I felt in my heart and soul that this was the last season.
And thus, Alex Morgan is retiring. And this was something that I think it sounds like she was planning to do at the end of the season. However, later in that 4.5-minute post, Anthony, she shared that she and her husband are, well, she really is the one who carries the literal weight here. She is pregnant with her second child. So Charlie, the beloved Morgan child, who is grown up in front of America's eyes as being a terrorist in post-game interviews of the cutest variety, she's going to be a big sister, which is awesome. And Alex Morgan's last game is suddenly this weekend. Her second to last game was last weekend against the Spirit. I actually talked to Tara Micchione from the Spirit today about that. That interview will be up on our Women's Sports YouTube page, hopefully by the end of the day. There's a lot going on. Might be up by tomorrow. But, Anthony, my big statement that I would say about Alex Morgan like the big defining, like first page of the it, what used to be like the biography, but now just like the first sentence on Wikipedia is Alex Morgan is the most important player to the growth of women's soccer in America, which as a sport has probably grown more than any other sport in America in the last 20 years. Alex Morgan is the single most important person in the growth of soccer and specifically women's soccer in America in the sport's history. And that is multifaceted. And some people know about her on-field greatness. She was a part of the 2015 and 2019 World Cup champions. She burst onto the scene as a 23-year-old in the 2011 World Cup. And everyone's like, who's that baby horse out there? That was the nickname she was given because of her running style. Kind of galloped downfield past everybody and came on, scored some important goals. Just an incredible player. She's fifth all-time on the U.S. Women's National Team in goals scored. And one of the all-time leading scorers in the NWSL. A league, by the way, that she's been playing long enough that she played before this league existed. I know because I was there at the last game she played in the old league. Rochester, New York, 2013. No, sorry, 2011. The WPS Championship game in front of 10,000 people in Rochester, New York, Anthony. And I was like, this league looks like it has promise coming off the 2019 World Cup. Folded 3 weeks later. And then the NWSL got founded, and Alex spent a lot of her career in Orlando. She was here in 2019 when the Spirit played at Audi Field for the first time, and they sold it out. Eventually went to San Diego when that expansion team started. She wanted to be back home in California and raise her family there. And people know about the on-field greatness. What I don't know if the average fan knows is how much she did off the field. And obviously the equal pay lawsuit, she was a huge part of all the negotiations and the attention, frankly, because she is someone who, like, Megan Rapinoe is a beloved figure, but she's also polarizing, for better or for worse. I'm not here to debate whether you love or hate Megan Rapinoe, but chances are you love or hate Megan Rapinoe. Alex Morgan's approval rating is like 1,000%. And her willingness to lend her voice to that cause, to be out front, to take on people in powerful places on the equal pay lawsuit that U.S. soccer had or faced from their women's national team was enormous. She also had the literal receipts of emails sent that brought down the last commissioner of the league when she didn't handle a complaint against a coach of sexual abuse properly. Alex Morgan, it wasn't just some player that had email receipts. It was Alex freaking Morgan who was like, oh, you said that this wasn't reported? You said this wasn't investigated? You tried to brush this aside? No, no, no. I'm Alex Morgan. I'm the most famous player in the entire sport, and you're dead now. And that was the end of Lisa Baird as the commissioner of the NWSL. And a lot of really great things, including the first ever collective bargaining agreement for the NWSL players, came out almost directly of Alex Morgan's willingness to be like, I'm going to use my popularity for good. And ultimately, like, to me, that's Morgan's legacy is, yes, inspirational player. There are more little girls and frankly little boys wearing number 13 U.S. jerseys than any other jersey in U.S. soccer in the last 20 years. But her willingness to use that fame and popularity for the advancement of things she believed in is the ultimate thing that we want out of our athletes. We want athletes who do good in the world. And Alex Morgan has done a tremendous amount of good in the world. And I have no doubt she will continue to moving forward. She will just do it as a retired player. So salute to you, Alex Morgan. Happy retirement. Best of luck to you and Servando, her husband, and Charlie and their family as they welcome baby number two at some point in the future. But yeah, if you want to watch Alex Morgan one more time, Sunday night on, I wonder if it gets picked up by a TV network. Right now it's supposed to just be a streaming game, but 8 o'clock against North Carolina on Sunday night. So yeah, that's the news of the day in soccer world. Outside of the fact that, Anthony, did you hear how Croy Bethune tore her meniscus? It's on around the horn right now.
Yeah, I just looked up and
she tore it throwing out the first pitch at the Nats game.
I can't even believe it.
I'm so mad. But we'll bite that for another time. It's not anyone's fault. It's just dumb luck. Dumb, stupid, bad, terrible luck. Anyway, apropos of none of that, Never Read the Comments is next. Commanders fans, what do they think of my cautious optimism for the 2024 season? It's the Hoffman Show. We're on the Team 980, always live as well on the free Odyssey app. And once again, being reminded right now about the fact that I get to enjoy the show in a way that literally no one else on the planet does, as Anthony just, like dancing away to the beat that the folks on the radio can hear but can't see Anthony, and the folks on the stream can't hear the beat because the copyrighted music is kept off the internet, but get to see Anthony dancing. What a treat for me.
What a treat. That song also just, I don't know, it gets me going, man. It just gets me going.
That was very reminiscent of, it gets the people going. Once the people get going, they get on the internet, they start leaving comments, and then we got to deal with them. It's time.
We tried to warn them. They didn't listen.
Yeah!
Every week, the Hoffman Show goes into the belly of the beast.
We read those comments, baby!
Never read the comments.
All right, this is how this works. We do the show. It's 3 hours long, between 4 and 7. It's live on the Team 980. It's live on the Odyssey app. It's live on 980's YouTube page. And then afterwards, we chop it all up, make it digestible. We take the segments, we take the meat, say, hey, this is what we talked about today. Digestible for you. And you go on the internet, you watch the parts of the show that you missed on demand, and you leave comments. And some of them are funny, some of them insightful, some of them are mean. I typically just delete those because we don't do that. We try to have a nice, welcoming community. And some are interesting enough that we decide to respond to them on the radio, and then we chop that up, and then we put that on demand, and then the cycle repeats itself. And that's kind of how it ends up working. But we call it Never Read the Comments. And we do it 5:30 on Thursdays live, and here we are. So we start with Matthew Hale, which I almost read, Anthony, as Matthew Whale. Matthew Hale, 8958, in response to our segment on the defensive preview. And for some reason, I'd have to go back and listen to what we said. A lot of John Allen trade comments came out of that segment. I was like, did we say something about trading John Allen? We might have, but there was a question that I thought was put forth innocently enough that it was worth answering. Anthony, realistically, do you think we trade Allen at the deadline if Newton shows out in the first half of the season, just trying to see the path forward if playoffs aren't on the table? Here's what I would say. It's possible, because everything outside of like trading Jaden Daniels is possible. I would say it's highly unlikely, right? You need a rotation of guys, first of all. And so if the defense is playing moderately well, it's going to be in part because those three guys, John, Duran, and Johnny, are all playing well. Allen, Payne, Newton, good rotation. They're keeping guys fresh. You know, Allen is not having to play too many snaps because Newton is taking some. Fedarian's probably playing all right ball. And they've hopefully elevated the play of the guys on the outside. They've overcome the what is perceived to be a lack of talent. And if they're playing well, that's why I'm phrasing it that way. I certainly have questions there on the edge. But they've overcome that because those inside guys are playing really well. If they're not playing well, if the defense is not playing well at all, then I don't know how high John Allen's trade value is. Realistically, if I was a team that could use a D tackle, maybe I have one of my top guys get hurt. Let's say like Chris Jones goes down, or you know, the Lions lose one of their guys, or like you're one of those top teams and you're like, I think we can get John Allen and it's worth giving up a second round pick for him. Would Adam Peters listen in the middle of the season if the Commanders aren't playing well? Yes. But I think they had a discussion last offseason. John talked about it on stage with us at the Team 980 versus 106.7 The Fan event, that they had a conversation and John bought into what they're building and he wants to be a part of it. I think John Allen's preference would be to retire as a Commander. Realistically, Adam Peters has got to do what's best for the team. And if Newton is crushing it and Allen's playing well, but the team overall is not playing very well, could they say like, hey, we're going to, like, you have no guaranteed money left. We're just going to go ahead and trade you and let someone else sign you to a new deal, a la what they did last year with the old regime and Montez Sweat. Yeah. And if you're going to get a high second round pick for that, or a late first even, which seems implausible for a guy his age, but maybe. I think you have to listen if you're Adam Peters. But it's such a fine line to walk, a small needle to thread, that I just don't think that is the likely outcome, Anthony.
Yeah. So I don't think we mentioned trade, but for some of the reasons you just named, like he doesn't have any guaranteed money like left on this deal. He has one more year. And also, you know, John has expressed that he wants to win. Like, he's tired of like being losing and, you know, being in a terrible place. So I think that's probably why the YouTube commenter maybe suggested we trade him. But
which, like, if you think of it as like, is he an expiring contract? Not really, but yeah, kind of, because you probably either re-sign him after the season or you might move on. Like, if you're going to move on, why wouldn't you move on early and get something? Like, mm-hmm. It's 100% on the table. I just don't think it's likely, because I think that they're going to want him here long term. Yep. He's done. And long term is 2 to 3 years, right? But you don't have to pay Jerzon Newton for 2 to 3 years. Yep. And so you can afford to have a little bit of a surplus there, especially if you're going to build your other expensive positions mostly through the draft. Like, one, they have a ton of space. Two, they're on a rookie quarterback timeline, which means you have $60 extra million in cap space that you're not spending on the Joe Burrows, the Dak Prescotts, the whoever is making $60 million a year this year, Mahomes, Lamar, like all those dudes are 50 plus. And Dak hasn't even gotten paid yet. And I think he's still making 50 this year. So he's going to make 60 plus probably. And so with all that extra money and the fact that hopefully your starting left tackle isn't going to be making big money because it's Brandon Coleman, and, you know, Terry's kind of in a similar situation to John contractually. So we'll see what they do with him financially. But corner, you're either like, I don't think you're spending huge money there. Edge, like, there's not a ton of edge rushers that get to the market. So maybe you wind up spending some money there. But realistically, you're probably drafting your future lead edge. So I just think that you have the financial flexibility right now to let John Allen be a part of your team and the culture setter and a, you know, a part of the spine of your defense that's really valuable, him and Duran, for the next couple of years. So you probably just continue on that path. But if for whatever reason you're like, man, Newton could be better than Allen, we need to make him the starter, and we think John wants to go, like, you know, our timeline maybe is a little slower, maybe as great as Jaden's looked so far, we think it's going to take 3 years to be at the peak of his powers, not a next year situation. Like, let's get John somewhere where he can maybe, you know, be a rotational piece on a championship team, and that team is willing to give you a second round pick, I think Adam Peters will listen. I just, again, you have to have John playing at a certain level, Jerzon playing at a certain level. We haven't seen Jerzon really play yet. And then you also need to have the team be at like the right balance of success and failure that makes it worth it. So it's a tough needle to thread. P. Laurel commented on our chat with Nate Tice from Friday. Big, long chat about Jaden, about offensive, defensive trends in 2024. And I picked this one out, Anthony, because I think it raises an interesting point. I'm admittedly going to get on a small high horse here, but I'm going to try to do it in a way that is not demeaning and talking down. I realize by admitting that I might be getting on a high horse, then people are automatically going to think I'm being arrogant, but that's the nature of the segment. It's an ask for appreciation of intelligence. From P. Laurel, Tice seems to be swimming upstream consistently on the topic of Daniels as a prospect. Forget about his NFL career for now because it hasn't happened yet. But of all the prospects, the most questionable floor is Mays. So how is it that Tice is saying May and Williams are the top two prospects he's seen in 10 years? I just wish someone would challenge some of the things Tice has said. Really makes me believe he's relying on measurables like size and not film. Practically every great pocket passer suffers a major injury at some point in their careers. Flip through them in your mind. So size, equating to durability, being a major factor in evaluation is ridiculous. I'll give you some credit for leaning McCarthy. He can play. Talking about me there. Going back to my pre-draft evals as if those are still relevant. And then last but not least, this guy sums up his comment. Ironically, he's also the latest pocket passer that has suffered a major injury. My response to him on the internet, and my response to him that I'll you know, regurgitate and paraphrase, I'll paraphrase myself out loud here, is if you are getting stuck on the final rankings of a really smart analyst, which I very much consider Nate Tice to be. And you are not listening to what they actually say. You're missing the whole point. We get obsessed with the graphic, right? Here's Nate Tice's top five QBs in the 2024 draft class. Here's Dan Orlovsky's. Here's Lewis Riddick's. Here's Trevor Sikkema's at PFF. Here's this guy. Here's that guy. Here's Hoffman's. Here's Paulson's. And then you ignore everything that we say when we've done some amount of homework and research and come at it from some level of expertise. And I'm certainly not putting myself on the same level as all those guys I just mentioned, but I don't know nothing, right? We've done an amount of homework to come to those conclusions. And when he says, I wish someone would challenge Nate on some of these things, I did at the combine. We had that conversation. And he was like, yes, the things you're saying that worry you about Drake May also worry me. I see them. You're not incorrect on the analysis. I just ultimately don't think they matter as much. And thus, I would take him on my hypothetical team, right? And he's also not drafting for a team. Nate said in the interview that we did last week that if he was Cliff Kingsbury as an offensive coordinator, the guy that he'd probably want is Jaden Daniels because the skill set matches the scheme, right? So there's nuance, one, that people just love to ignore for what's the baseline ranking on the graphic. And two, the point is not the graphic. The point is not the ranking. The point is the actual information. And then it's up to all of us to suss that out. The reason Nate and I came out with different rankings, even though we saw the players very similarly, is there's stuff, for instance, about Drake May that I just couldn't get over from a consistency standpoint by the end of the process. And there's certain stuff about Jaden Daniels not attacking the middle of the field, for instance, that he really, really values. And Drake May did that at an extremely high level. I don't disagree that there's more of Drake May on tape attacking the middle of the field in college than Jaden Daniels. I just looked at it and was like, I don't think that's an incapability. I think there's the fact that he had Malik Nabers and Brian Thomas on the outside, and he was making business decisions that were clearly good for business. He won the Heisman Trophy and was awesome, and their LSU team could have been a playoff team if their defense wasn't abysmal. So at the end of the day, every team, like real personnel evaluator, is going to have different things they value. And that is going to be both off their own experience and the system that they're trying to fit a player into. If you think there's, I'm sure GMs that love certain players that are like, oh, that edge player, that guy, I freaking love. I can't believe that he's available to me, but he doesn't fit my system and I can't draft him because my coaches don't have a use for him. That's the reality of the situation sometimes. So you can either ignore all that information, all the good intel that an analyst like a Nate Tice, a Lewis Riddick, a Dan Orlovsky, all these guys that we have on, Logan Paulson on Take Command, give you and just be like, but they ultimately said ABC and I think BCA. And often when we say ABC, it's like, I guess A, but I really like B and C too. And the comments are, why do you hate B? I don't. And so my hope would be that if you hear this mini rant, that you go, instead of getting mad and being like, well, then don't do whatever, just take it. Anthony with me. Woosa. Hey, the whole point of listening to smart people is to get smarter. So I'm going to listen to the smart people and take in the information and be more informed about the game. I know that's not how it's actually going to work for some people, but there are some people listening, I would say probably a silent majority, who will be like, yeah, that's a good point. I'm going to try to be better about that. Did I do a good job of not being too high horsey?
I think so.
Are you saying that just to make me feel good, or did I actually do a good job?
I think you did a good job.
Okay. I'm sure someone will tell me otherwise. Confidence is high. Continuing on, never read the comments. We posted another one of Marvin's calls, Anthony, because they're entertaining. Chaos Nux says,
Marvin's call was odd. He wanted Quinn, but will relentlessly scrutinize Adam Peters. Also, with how crazy the wide receiver market is, because remember, he wanted either T. Higgins or Devontae Adams or Jamar Chase, I think was it? It was Higgins or Chase after the season. He goes, you really want to have two marquee receivers on the roster you got to pay? That's not a long-term winning strategy for me. Look, remember all the things I said about all the smart people that we have on the show?
Yep.
We book those guests, then people get to call in and give their opinion on the caller listener line. And we screen those calls. And so not all of them make the air. And not all the ones that make the air we're having on for the substance of the content.
Wow.
I'm just saying, Marvin's entertaining as hell. His takes are they're incredibly mind-blowing. Like, it's entertaining because it's a workout for your brain to figure out, does this make any sense? Yeah. He had his most sensical call this week, and I hated 78% of it.
I thought a lot of Marvin's call, just because of how vastly improved the call was compared to his others. So I think he gets an A for effort.
Yeah, we'll take the A for effort. Here's what else I would say is there's always a guy in the barbershop who's wrong and loud.
Yep.
And they're almost as loud as they are wrong. And everyone just kind of laughs, and then eventually the adults start talking.
Yeah.
That was probably a little harsh. The adults start talking. But like, if you've been in the barbershop, it's true. And eventually someone looks at him, and typically one of the barbers, like, hey, and this used to happen when I would go, especially to black barbershops, they know what I did and they'd be like, this dude like actually covers the, and I was like on the beat at the time. And they'd be like, this dude knows stuff. We're trying to get info. We're trying to get the inside scoop. Marvin, shut up. We asked him the question. Don't you think? Man, shut up. One of the barbers eventually just look at him. Man, shut up.
Nah, some people do really have really, really, really poor takes. And when I'm in there, you know, sometimes I just sit back and like listen, I laugh. Like even my dad, I think my dad has some really bad takes.
Shout out Big Tony.
Shout out Big Tony. And I just sit back, you know, I listen. I sit back and listen, I just laugh. And my mom does the same thing because she knows sometimes he just is very irrational. So, you know, you just got to let them be irrational and then
when they get it out.
Yeah, just let them get it out.
And sometimes we do that for entertainment purposes here on the radio.
Exactly.
Every time Marvin calls. This one I thought was fun from Wonderful Faison. I'm fascinated. We talked about the in a pick six last week, Anthony, that they're not going to do team captains this year on like a season-long basis. It's going to be a weekly thing for them. And someone goes, I'm fascinated with this approach they're taking with being a captain. I'm even more intrigued by the sub-leaders he will choose. Should they have a nickname, the inner circle, the round table, the core, so many options? Because they're going to have a leadership council, but they're not going to have formal captains. Whoever is the captain will change on a weekly basis, or the captains on a weekly basis. And someone replied with the potential nickname options, the cabinet. I like that. For a DC team,
cabinet?
I hate most political jokes,
uh-huh.
But like the idea that like, hey, we got our Secretary of Defense, we got our, you know, all the other cabinet positions, you know, leader of the Secretary of the Department of the Interior, like we got Secretary of Education, like we got all these people that are advising the leader. And while Dan Quinn is not the president, obviously, he's the head coach. I like the idea for a DC group. Like it kind of is like, hey, let's have a cabinet meeting. Let's get the important principals in here to talk about this.
No, that does make sense. You flush it out.
Yeah. Do you have any other nicknames that you'd like to put forth, Anthony?
No.
Okay. I don't either. I wish I'd saved more time for this one. And then we got a couple of punishment suggestions, Anthony. They're not very good. So that's, but we'll read them anyway. Actually, there's one that I don't mind. Mr. J. Smitty 555. Craig, I have a genuine question unrelated to the topic of the video, but I felt like you would give a thoughtful response.
Why, thanks, Jay Smitty. Is the media's main purpose in gathering information in press conferences ultimately for the fans? It's disseminated in the form of an editorial, podcast, or radio show, but main purpose seems to be for the fan. Why isn't there a designated list of fan-made questions screened by the teams asked at every press conference? Good question. The premise here, I would say, is correct. Ultimately, our job is to be the liaison between you, the fans, and the team. I've told that to many a PR folk before. Been like, hey, I don't know what you're doing to me right now, but like my listeners are your fans. And so if you want to reach them, hello. But we're an important neutral kind of step in all of that. What you don't want is fans asking like you don't want the team screening the questions, because they could pick out all the ones that they don't want to answer. That's part of the reason why we have jobs. Our job, and we're professionally trained to get information, and hopefully we are skilled in asking questions in a way that, you know, fans wouldn't. We used to do a segment, Anthony, we might bring this back at some point. We did the segment where we'd have fans call in with questions, and I would reframe the question and how I thought it should be asked in a press conference, and then try my best to answer it. If you're good at the job, you can get better information than, say, a fan would, because a fan's like, why does this guy suck? And a journalist might be like, it seems that player X, had some issues this week. What is it that he's not grasping that you're trying to get him to accomplish? And a coach is going to respond much better to that than, why did your guy suck? So there is just kind of a one. We might have information, too, that I think that's the other thing is like, press conferences are a small piece of the puzzle. Real reporting happens behind the scenes. You have to know information to get information. And so if it's just, hey, here's what fans want to know in a press conference setting, you're actually not going to learn that much. It's the ability in an editorial piece, whether it's a radio show, a column, a news article, whatever, to take the things that we learn behind the scenes, not at a press conference, because people aren't willing to say it at a press conference, with what's said at a press conference to create a more complete picture. That would be my answer to that question. All right. Last but not least, Anthony, we asked for more punishment ideas for our weekly Competition Wednesday segment. We're going to pick three games against the spread, and the loser, the worst record of those three games, is ultimately going to have to do something on a wheel of punishment / reward. Either one would work. And of course, people wanted to send in more punishments than rewards. I thought this was mean. Mr. Swervon, loser has to listen to Nick Wright talk about Pat Mahomes and LeBron James for an hour straight. Why are we taking shots at Nick Wright?
First of all, I love Nick Wright, and I wouldn't mind doing that because I love LeBron James.
That's also true. That's like a reward for Anthony. He gets to listen to Nick Wright talk about LeBron James. Also, you just have to listen to their show, and you know that'll happen inherently. Yeah. This one I thought was funny. It's a total misunderstanding of the show, Anthony. Gibbs fan 19, punishment for Craig, switch your roles for one show. If Craig loses, Craig produces, and Anthony gets to host. Punishment for Anthony, if Anthony loses, he has to produce with Linnell in the same booth as him for one show, with Craig in the show host booth as he normally is, but Ant and Linnell must be together producing in the same booth. That would be punishment for you, but you don't need any help. Linnell would be a detriment on the producer side. That's why when Linnell is here, we have him over with me.
Yeah.
Also, Anthony getting to host the show is actually Anthony's nightmare. We've talked about this before. Anthony is not a producer who secretly wants to be a host. There are many of those in our industry. That is not Anthony's dream. It's actually Anthony's nightmare. He has had actual nightmares about it, that all of a sudden I lost my voice or called out sick last minute and he had to host the show.
That is true. I do not want to be a show host.
So that could actually be a pretty funny, like the punishment would be Anthony has to, we wouldn't do the whole show.
Maybe a segment.
But Anthony has to host a segment.
Okay.
That would be pretty funny. I'm not
going to lie. I will come in here.
You'd be so prepared.
I would get here 5 hours early.
For one segment.
For one segment. It will be scripted. It will be mapped out. I will be ready, though.
Last but not least, Mike from Southwest. This one I kind of low-key like. Regarding the bet, loser has to open and close a show during the week with a haiku about losing. I don't know if we have to do a haiku about losing, but like something related to maybe one of the games that you lost, you have to write a haiku.
That's like a perfect, that's the right amount for a weekly punishment.
Yeah, that's funny, actually.
All right, I'm going to put that on the list. We're adding haiku to the list. Okay. All right, when we get back, speaking of picking games, we're gonna pick our division winners and everything else you can pick for an NFL season for the 2024 season. That's next on the Team 980.
Sometimes in football, you need just a little more for that first down. You need to be pushing the pile. And on our new podcast, we'll give you that extra effort.
I'm Mike Renner, a longtime NFL analyst who helped develop player evaluation systems that every NFL team uses to this day.
And I'm Kyle Long, former All-Pro offensive lineman in the NFL who knows a thing or two about getting people moving.
You'll get expertise from inside the trenches and behind the tape for 4 episodes every week. So make sure you download and subscribe to the Pushing the Pile podcast on the Odyssey app.